Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com. This is Floss Weekly with Chris DeBona, episode 17 for March 21st, 2007, Mad Dog. We didn't lie. We're back. Yes, that's two in a row now, Chris. We're on a roll. Floss Weekly is back with a great guest this time around. Chris DeBona, a good day to you.
Hello, Leo. Hello, everybody.
In your lovely special place that you...
My pod.
You live and work in. Chris is the open source program manager for Google, but of course he doesn't represent...
You haven't been down here in a while. We ought to have you down.
I'm dying to come down.
I ought to give a tech talk. People here... It's funny. Last time you were here, I had a couple of people come up to me. Hey, was that Leo Laporte?
Really?
I'm like, your people are here, man. Yeah.
I don't have anything to say to them. I'd love to hear what they have to say. Is it true that the plan for global domination was erased?
I'm one of the erasers. So I have to tell you this, Leo. Sometimes the whole tour mentality of Google drives me a little crazy. It's like, oh, there's a lot of important things going on here, but it's all computer science, right? So when people overfocus on, like, you know, the food or some of the fun things that are around here, you know, that I love, I get a little like, oh, no, it's the computers that matter, you know? And so the master plan had been up there for a little over a year. And I was like, you know what? It's time to erase it.
We should say what it is. It's a big whiteboard.
Big whiteboard. Yeah.
And then I just guess Google employees started writing, you know, the plan for world domination. And it just kind of went along. And there was stuff from Vint Cerf and all sorts of stuff on there.
Well, there was one particular Googler who started it. And that was Amit Patel. And Amit Patel, if you look for his name in Google, you'll find he's like this AI master. Right. And it had been up there for a while, and it was actually color coded, you know, with the kind of things that we were going to do. And so it was great. Brilliant. And then other people added all these things, and it got kind of messy and kind of dirty, and people like leaning against the board and like, oh, that got erased. Oops, you know.
Oops.
And then somebody would add like horoscopes, and then they'd go erase it, you know, stuff like that. And so I finally decided, you know what? It's getting old. It's getting crufty. You know, Google, we should not be held down by the strings of the past. So
you,
I sent off an email.
You decided this?
So I sent off an email to the MISC list, said, hey, I want to erase the I'm going to erase the master plan unless I get lynched between now and 11 o'clock Thursday morning or 10 o'clock Thursday morning. So, you know, I wrote back, and then like most people were like, but oh, you're right. It's old. You know? And then so he said, well, will there be champagne?
Oh, that's more important. Yeah.
And so I went and talked to the cafe guys. I'm like, can we get some food and stuff? And they're like, sure. You know, so we had some mimosas and some
you made a party out of it.
So we made a party out of it. So,
pictures of it before it was erased?
Yeah. So I did take pictures. They're up on the internet. If you just type in Google Master Plan and look for the most recent ones, you can't miss it. Somebody made like a Google Maps where you can sort of drag through it.
Oh, neat. Oh, that's neat.
Yeah. And then I also did a video, which I'll put up someday, but I don't think it's that important. Look, they're erasing something. Ooh. You know?
Well,
So we erased it. And then, about four or five months later, a bunch of our guys from Chicago were over, and they're like, this master plan they've got up right now is pretty ugly. I'm like, let's go erase it. So we want to erase that one too.
So it's been through two iterations. Now what's what's on the whiteboard now?
It's another one. You know, people keep on putting now it's like flow diagrams is what you see on that board now. It's sort of everyone knows that. So
I see.
So yeah. But yeah, and we leave a little area alone now where like people who come authors at Google come and sort of sign and say something, you know. So
I think it's really
that's
fun.
Pretty cool.
I think it's really fun.
Now the one I didn't erase is over in building 42, which is the ancient master plan, which has a picture of the Earth with like a tunnel dug through it for faster latency and you know. And that one's really creative, so I can't bring myself to erase that one.
I think somebody needs to put that under plexiglass quick.
Oh, you know, I gotta agree. That one's really sort of classic.
That's historic. Yeah.
Yeah.
So speaking of historic, we've got a wonderful guest on the show today.
He's like a fossil.
Well, he's been around for a long time, and
yeah,
he's
so,
probably
yeah.
done more than any single individual, except maybe Linus, to promote Unix and Linux.
Yeah, I have to agree. I mean, Mad Dog's been everywhere and has done everything. So it's scary. I mean, you talk about somebody who has like a million miles in their frequent flyer miles. It's insane. This guy has been everywhere.
John Mad Dog Hall. I don't know what you can say to introduce him.
Let's just get started.
All right. My first question was, is it true he knows everybody?
Well, not everybody. I mean, there's this person that's, he lives only about 17 miles from my house, and I've never really met him.
Well, it's a chance to meet him.
There you go.
Some random guy.
Stranger on the streets kind of interview, you know?
He makes cheddar cheese.
So. Yeah. Actually, there was a guy who's into our technology newspaper here in Milford, and he's the science editor for it, of the little town newspaper we have. And he took us to the printing office of the Milford Cabinet newspaper the other day. And this was when they were still using the linotype machines to set the slugs, you know, of lead to be printed. And one day they all of a sudden went to electronic publishing, where they didn't need that anymore. So they just kind of like closed the door of the printing office. There's still cigarette butts left in the ashtrays from 30 years ago. And so it's kind of like a combination museum and shrine to the ancient printing thing.
And that's really something.
Yeah, it was great. And he's a very interesting guy to talk to. So we could even have him on. He's one of those people that started off years ago saying, Linux will never amount to anything, you know, and phew. So
he may still be proven to be right, you know.
Well, I think that it has amounted to something, and probably, as you know, I mean, no matter what happens in the future, you can say it had at least as much impact as DOS or a lot of the other things that have faded into insignificance. But yeah. I think that Linux and free and open source has, you know, some small impact. So
okay, if you put it on a list, it would be above BOS but under Windows. Somewhere in there, right?
Well, you know, it all depends on how you gauge things, right? What is the importance of them to you, and where do things go? And of course, you have to separate Linux from the free and open source concept. You know, right.
Where would the internet be without Apache? You know,
yeah. And what is the direction of software development going to be in the future? Was the closed source proprietary software, which I believe will be around for a long time, but is that model just really a blip in the whole model of free of software development?
Or is it the future?
I think that the closed source proprietary software, in a lot of ways, unless it changes dramatically, is going to be fading, because from my viewpoint, it can't meet all the needs of the people. And this is why it becomes very frustrating for people, that they try and get the software to do what they want it to, and they can't, because there's this company that has limited resources and also has to bring a profit, so they have to balance off the revenue that they're bringing in versus the expenses of the engineer, and they're trying to use the commodity model for software of meeting 90% of the people's needs 80% of the time, or you can juggle those percentages any way you want to, but the person at the far end who has the unique need, they have little or no influence on the vendor of the software. Only in mass do they have influence. And consequently, they can't get their individual need met. The need of the user has to bend to the way the software works instead of the other way around. And of course, some software vendors say, well, This is why we do best practices, right? We know the best way of doing this, and our software reflects that. And so, if you want to do business, you do it our way. And this, you know, it doesn't always work out like that. And so, free and open source, you know, as people get used to it, we'll begin to understand that you can change the software, even if you don't have the skills to do it, by hiring somebody else that can.
But you said an interesting thing before we got underway that kind of relates to this. You said that Linux no longer needs to be evangelized.
Well, it yes and no. It's changing.
We should say that, for those who don't know, I don't know who wouldn't know, that you for many years, really have been in many ways the chief evangelist of Linux. I mean, that's who Mad Dog is in many ways.
I'm one of them. There's been lots of evangelists. Go ahead, Chris.
I said, and before that, you know, Unix. I mean, a lot of people don't realize, but Mad Dog's history stretches back into the dusty environs of the original Unix, you know?
Well, and actually, before that, when I was a student at university, I was first started off as an electrical engineer, and after I saw two of my friends nearly electrocuted by 13,600 volts and 800 amps, I decided to switch over to software.
That would discourage you real quick.
Yeah, and computers, because, you know, for the most part, it was 12 volts and a milliamp, you know, do it to me. But, you know, I switched over to software. Now, software back in those days, because of the huge expense of the computers, the lack of networking for the most part, the few number of books and magazines that were available that told you how to write software, all of these things rolled in together meant that there was a relatively small market for the software that was generated. Plus, every computer had a different architecture, and they were all gigantic and very expensive.
This was in the days of Baxen, or what kind of, what was
like
the
well, Burroughs 5500, Univax, IBM mainframes like the 360, PDPs were coming out, had been out. Actually, one of the machines that I worked on in my early days was the PDP-8 that had a 4,000 word memory to it, where the words were 12 bits apiece. But we could do amazing things on it, really. I mean, we had Fortran compilers that would fit into that. We had text editors and things. You know, I mean, it was really amazing. But the machines were phenomenally expensive. I mean, you know, $100,000 for a machine that had 4K of memory and set on a desktop, and you know, that was when $100,000 was a lot of money. My parents bought their house for $29,000.
Wow. So it's more like $1 million would be today, really.
Yeah. I mean, you know, they were phenomenally expensive. And the software was expensive, too.
And you couldn't even play Half-Life 2 on it.
You could play Space Wars if you were lucky, right?
Not on that one.
Well, no. Actually, a machine called the Link 8, which was a combination of the Link computer, which was a medical computer that was also 12-bit, but had wired instructions and therefore was very expensive to make. It flipped its instructions over to a PDP-8 where they were emulated, and on that you could actually play Space Wars with a little graphics tube, a little oscilloscope. Yeah. And the little rocket would come in, and you would try and control it to, you know, fire its retros and stuff and fire its missiles. And if you were too close to the edge of the oscilloscope, the missile would go off one end and come in the other side of the oscilloscope. It was kind of like
just like in real life.
Yeah. And we had a lot of fun with that. But, you know, these, by today's standards, certainly, very small memory space computers would do quite a bit. But the software, if you purchased it, was phenomenally expensive because, you know, companies that were making it had a relatively limited market, and it took a lot of time to create a compiler. And particularly back in those days when there was no such thing as computer science, it was all computer black magic, you know. Compiler theory was just that, theory. And people were stumbling in the dark trying to make these things, and they were progressively getting better. So, you know, you might spend $100,000 for a single copy of a compiler of some type, particularly if it was good, not $39.95 down at your local CompuHut, right?
Or free from download from the Free Software Foundation.
There you go. Absolutely.
So you're playing with these old Burroughs and Univax and early PDPs, and you're doing software. Mm-hmm. What kind of software are you writing?
Well, I wanted to write as a project for the university. I wanted to write a and I did write a program which printed out in Braille on paper tape. And if you had the right type of tape to put into the ASR33 teletype, you could punch out holes in the tape. And then what you did was you ran the tape over a little wheel that had bumps in it, and basically you could allow people to feel the bumps or not feel the bumps according to where the holes were or not have the holes. And I wanted to try and be able to automate, in effect, a linear Braille system with that. And that's why I spent my time as my project working on in, you know, as my university project back then.
Now, at that time, there was no open source. There was no Unix.
But yes, there was open source. That's the point. That's why I started this. There was an organization called DECUS, the Digital Equipment Corporation User Society. And IBM had one, too, called Share. And they had libraries where people would donate their programs to the libraries. And they would donate the programs because these people were not programmers per se. They were scientists. They were engineers. They were people who wanted to who had a job to do. And they said, hey, I need to write some software to do this job. And then they had the software and they said, well, what am I going to do with this, right? Am I going to sell it? Well, selling software is really hard. You have to have salespeople. You have to advertise. You have to have some type of support. You have to do quality control and everything. And these people say, hey, you know, I don't have the time for this. I'm a scientist. I'm an engineer. I'm a business person. So they contributed their software to this library. And the library would, you know, categorize it and things like that, a lot like SourceForge does today in a lot of ways. And then they would publish a catalog that you could buy for $5 through the mail because there wasn't any real networking. And then you could look in the catalog and see what type of software you wanted and what operating system it ran on. Well, I say operating system. We didn't really have real operating systems back in those days, but
operating
some of the software worked on, you know, directly on the bare machine. And as a matter of fact, I have in front of me right now, I just reached over to my bookcase to get this, the DECUS Digital Equipment Corporation User Society Individual Literature Kit and the catalog of software from, geez, it must be around 1968 or 69. Oh, 72. Here we go. Object or binary tapes, $1 per program. ASCII or source tapes, $5 per program.
And you're really paying for the medium, not the program.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
You paid a little, because they had people who did this professionally. They answered they opened the mail and everything back at the DECUS headquarters, and it was a little bit for their time of punching it out and so forth. But here is a conversational two-dimension fitting program for the PDP-9L, program to histogram data from forward events. It's using a laboratory-oriented computer called the Lab 8.
So was DECUS the first users group?
I don't know that it was the first users group. It was an early user group because there was, you know, you didn't have software. I mean, you didn't have a CompuHut. You know, you couldn't go down to your corner store and buy software off the shelf, because if you tried to buy a computer there, you need an 18-wheel tractor trailer truck to haul your computer home. You know, you didn't have shrink wrap software because there were so many different architectures, it didn't make sense to generate mass amounts of binary-only software for that. You know, like I said before, there was Share. I'm sure that as Hewlett-Packard came out, and I know there were Hewlett-Packard groups that traded programs for the calculators, the programmable calculators, for instance. And so, you know, there were local user groups like the Boston Computing Society that for many years had meetings and covered a wide range of different computer systems. And they would have meetings every month, kind of like the Linux user groups do today.
Well, a lot of those old computer user groups turned into Linux user groups in the late 90s, we were seeing in the Valley. Yeah.
And they did in Boston, too. I mean, I think one of the last groups that was out of the Boston users group and then managed to survive was the Linux user group. But the interesting thing about the DECUS thing was that the people that contributed the program Sadiqa's Library did the same thing for a lot of the same reasons that people do today that contribute free software. They said, hey, I had to write the software anyway for my own use. Why not let somebody use it? Or, hey, I did this software. Maybe somebody will help me improve it and make it better, and then we can share the work between us. Or maybe somebody will like my software, and the next time I go to a Deacus event, they'll buy me a beer. Or maybe they'll buy me dinner.
Nothing has
Or maybe
changed.
They'll give me a job.
Right. But there was no licensing out there.
Well, there was the same licensing that if you contributed the software, you had to expect that Deacus was going to distribute it, and that the software was typically freely copyable. I don't see anything in here about, in fact, I don't even see anything in here about licensing
at
per
all,
se.
Probably, this, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So it was really more the culture, but the culture was that you would be able to, you'd have the source, you'd be able to copy it. What was mm-hmm. it? Was there a standard for how you would attribute it, whether you would be required, you know, that kind of viral thing of the GNU public license where you'd be required to put your product into the public domain or open source as well? Anything like that in the culture?
Again, it's not, I didn't see anything about that. And certainly,
yeah,
you know, probably there were people who did take something that somebody had done and, you know, try and make a product out of it. But again, it was extremely difficult to make a product back in those days. And so a lot of people were happy just to have access to the code and use it for their own use and try and improve it a little bit. The other interesting thing is, as a college student, even $5 was a lot of money for me. Beers were 50 cents a piece back
My
then.
My God.
So you had to, you know, you had a choice between
it was 10
a
times the
editor.
Price of beer.
Yeah, well,
that's a lot of
you know,
money.
And as a college student, you had a choice between a text editor and 10 pitchers of beer. When I said a beer was 50 cents, I mean a pitcher of beer.
Oh,
was
now
50
you're
cents.
Now you're really talking here. Wait a minute, that's it. Let's the pitcher.
Ten pitchers of beer.
It wasn't great beer. It wasn't great beer. Okay,
it's college beer.
yeah, college beer from the railroad pub in Philadelphia. I think they've gone out of business, so it's okay to mention a name.
You were at Drexel
in any case,
at the time?
Yeah, I was going to Drexel right across the street from University of Penn. But that was a lot of, you know, it was a lot of money, $5. I mean, I was on a meal plan at the university that gave me $1.20 a day. So this is basically kind of almost a week's worth of meal plan for this text editor. And so what I would do is I would go to the school store, get a lot of paper tape, get the tape from Deacus and make copies of it and sell it to my roommates for $1 a copy. And that way they got to have, you know, by the time I made 5 copies, they got to have a copy of the software for themselves. They didn't have to borrow mine or wait around for me. And
you should have charged $1.10, then you could have gotten a pitcher of beer at the end of it.
Well, you know, I didn't want to be greedy, and I could have sold more copies as it was. But again, what I was doing was selling the service of first ordering the software, you know, checking its quality, making the copies, you know, distributing it, keeping a master copy around in case somebody's copy got destroyed. And of course, I didn't, you know, if they came to me and said, hey, I bought a copy from you, and you know, they were paying for the service of getting the copy and not having to wait for the 10 days it would take to send the money off to Deacus to come back. So that was my little service that I had for people. And so even back in 1969, a lot of the service mentality of the free and open source software space was there. And it was when computers started to come into mass production that the service aspect of software turned more and more into a product aspect of software, to be manufactured as a product. And it has the same type of effect as a person who wants to have a coffee cup that is made to their hand and their own color that they like with their name spelled correctly on the cup, the right size that they want, done by a potterer. And the potter, you give the specifications to the potter, and they make it. And if you don't like the one, well, maybe they'll remake it. as opposed to going down to your local, you know, Pier 1 or whatever and getting a mass-produced coffee cup that may not fit your hand or has your name spelled incorrectly, but it holds some coffee and it's a lot less expensive. The question is, what do you want? And is what is the value of that cup to you, not the cost? So, you know, I see moving forward, again, the computer industry reflecting on the fact that it's difficult today for some vendors to meet the needs of the 900 million personal computers that are out there that over the years have come from a predominantly English or European speaking language set, from a predominantly educated, trained group of people, fitting into a group of people that do not speak English or European languages as a first language and have a completely different culture than we do. And how do they get the software to meet their needs, particularly when they don't have enough revenue stream to interest certain manufacturers? And I think the free and open source is that path. So that's why I'm very, that's one of the main reasons why I'm very excited about it. And maybe it's just because I go back so far and I remember what it was like before the CompuHut, before the binary shrink wrap software and what you could do with it that keeps me so excited about it in the future. A lot of people have never experienced that. They started using computers after that period of time. And they've never, you know, it's like a lot of kids go around today and think that music comes on a silver platter with little earbuds you stick in your ear.
Actually, they think it comes from iTunes. So.
Right, right. I was about to say, I was dating myself, downloaded, you know, off of the internet. And I know that music really started with the player piano and the Edison cylinder phonograph.
Well, you know, it's funny. Leo used to run a show called The Screensavers, and one of those wax cylinders broke on the air on the show.
Ooh. Oh.
Do you remember this,
Leo? That would have been heartbreaking. But, you know, it's also interesting that when the Edison phonograph came out, there was this one person who was incensed about it, and he went to Congress, and he said,
and you know who it was,
much?
Right?
I'm about to get to it.
Okay.
He went to Congress and he said, this is terrible. It's going to destroy the music industry. It's going to destroy everything. Go ahead, Chris. Who was it?
It was John Philip Sousa.
Yep. So. And he was just adamant that it was going to create basically a read-only consumer, you know, culture, and that people were not going to be creative and they weren't going to make music.
Here's exactly what he said. These talking machines are going to ruin the artistic development of music in this country. When I was a boy, in front of every house in the summer evenings, you would find young people together singing the songs of the day. Today, you hear these infernal machines going night and day. We will not have a vocal cord left. The vocal cord will be eliminated by a process of evolution. That was the tale of man when he came from the ape.
So you know, I mean, and that was very good, Chris. And, you know, we've been hearing this since the dawn of time, okay? The cassette tape is going to destroy the record industry. Everything's going to destroy the, you know. And it's really amazing. And it just comes down to me that everybody objects to things until they can figure out how to make money from it, and then it's okay.
And they predict that, yeah. So tell me about how you actually personally found Linux itself, because you actually have a fairly rich history there that started very, very early. How did you run into Linus? How did that start?
Okay, well, I was working for Digital Equipment Corporation, and by that time I was in technical marketing, and I was in the Unix group. I had been in the Unix group for a long time, since 1983, and it was about January of 1994 when I got this thing in the mail, or maybe I saw it in a Dr. Dobbs journal, but it said a complete Unix operating system for on a CD with all the source code included. And I said, wow, that's kind of cool. And it was $100. I remember that. I ordered it and I got it. And it was from a little company called Yggdrasil.
Right.
I remember.
And unfortunately, I didn't have a PC to run it on. I had, you know, VAX Unix systems. I had MIPS Unix systems. There were a few alpha systems floating around, but I didn't have access to a Intel-based system. So I took the CD and I mounted it on my Alteryx machine, and I looked at the man pages, and I said, hey, that was pretty cool, you know, but I didn't have anything to run it on, so I put it away and stored it in my filing cabinet. And then about February of 1994, a friend of mine named Kurt Riesler, who was the head of the Unix Special Interest Group of DECUS. There's DECUS again. Rises up. It keeps coming like the phoenix of DECUS, who was a really good guy and has a lot of great ideas and everything. He was a volunteer to DECUS. He was trying to get this person to come over from Europe to talk about this project that I had never heard of. And to talk to the DECUS group about it. And he kept sending off these letters to these different companies, you know, like Soft Landing Systems and, you know, and stuff like that. And the person who was working with some type of software called Slackware, you know, and saying, hey, you know, could you help us with a donation to get this person to come across and talk to DECUS? And they kept copying me on all these letters. And of course, I got the answer back. They said, well, we're just a small company. We don't have much money, but we can give you lots of CDs to give away. And finally, I went to my management and I said, I don't know who this guy is, and I don't know what he did. But a lot of times, Kurt has some pretty good ideas, so I think we should listen to him and maybe fund this guy to come over. And so my management went to their management and said, we don't know who this guy is or what he did, and we don't even know who Kurt is, but Mad Dog sometimes has good ideas, so I think we should listen to him. So we got about $5,000 together to pay for the airfare for this person, and then Kurt wanted a PC to run the software on, and that really got to me because our group wasn't responsible for PC sales. We were responsible for VAXs and MIPS systems and things that were real workstations, you know, not this crummy, crappy, miserably weak thing from Intel. But I got him one. And so we went down to New Orleans. And, of course, New Orleans is the adult Disneyland. And we went down there. We won't get in trouble for saying that, will we?
No, adult. Not at all. It just means Mickey Mouse is smoking a cigarette. It's okay.
Or drinking, yeah. And we went down there, and I met up with Kurt, and he was trying to install this software on this PC. And I could have told him right away what the problem was, is that the PC didn't have an operating system on it yet. You had to, you know, put an operating system on the PC before you could install any software on it. But he was determined he was going to try and put this software directly on the PC, and he was having problems. And along came this nice young man with sandy brown hair, wearing glasses and sandals with wool socks on, and said, can I help you?
He must have been Finnish.
And yeah, he had this little lilting tone to his voice, right? I couldn't quite place the accent, but, you know. And Kurt kind of looked at him and smiled and said, yeah, I think... you could do that. And about 10 minutes later, Linux was running on the box. And as far as I know, that was the first time that Linus had ever installed Linux off of a CD.
Wow.
Because he didn't have a CD drive on his own home system. He would just build the thing on another disk drive and boot off of that. So then they invited me to sit down and try it out. And... all right, so I have to tell you, I collect player pianos, okay? I collect player pianos and automated musical instruments of all types. And I can tell you that when you play a piano, there's almost any piano will make a sound, right? And if it's properly tuned, it may even make a reasonable sound. And if it's got a good soundboard, it'll make a wonderful sound. But there's also the way you play it. And sometimes the piano keyboard is stiff and unresponsive. Other times it's perfectly weighted and it's just a joy to play. Well, that was like this little system. Even though it was one of these weak, miserable, crummy PCs, as I sat down to log in, it was responsive, and all the things seemed to be in the right place. And even though it was kind of like a mixture of BSD and System 5, everything was where I expected it to be. And I said, wow, this is really incredible. And the more I worked with it, the more incredible it was. And I went to, you know, the talks that Linus gave and, you know, listened to him and talking about free software. And, of course, like I said, all through time, I've been using free software of one type or another. I had helped to bring out a package we called Good Stuff at Digital for our Ultrix and Digital Unix products. That was a collection of free software that people needed to run on our systems. Our product management was very much against that because they said, well, what if we get sued or anything else? I said, look, people are bringing this software over on their own. Why don't we just do it once for everybody instead of having each one have to do it by themselves, right? And it was tremendously successful and tremendously appreciated by our customer base. So here I am, and I'm listening to this, and things start to click. And I said, wow, it'd be really nice if we could get this software ported to the alpha, because I wanted to have something where people could do experimentation with very large address spaces and be able to find out how to better use really large address spaces. And I said, you know, this was a reasonable thing to do with this bot because you got all the source code for it. So I took Linus out on the Natchez, which is a steamboat that goes up and down the Mississippi River. And I was talking to him, and I said, and we had this wonderful drink in our hand called a hurricane, which if you have a couple of them, it feels like you've been hit by a tropical depression like Katrina, right?
They'll blow you away.
Yeah. And we're riding up and down the river, and Linus loves steam engines. So we took him back and saw the big steam engine and everything. And we were up on the front, up in the bow of the boat, going down the river. And I said, Linus, have you ever thought about porting Linux to the alpha? It's a 64-bit system. You could get the kernel 64-bit clean. And, oh, by the way, you would be able to make sure that you not have any Intelisms inside the kernel. And it would give you a chance to separate out your kernel tree to be able to support multiple architectures. And he says, yes, I've been thinking about that, but I've been having a lot of trouble trying to get an alpha from the digital office in Helsinki. They've been trying, but it's been hard. I may have to do the PowerPC instead. Now, as I said, I was in technical marketing for digital, and I knew that this was the wrong answer. I don't remember screaming, which people said I did, but I do remember dropping... I do remember dropping the hurricane onto the deck in this little plastic cup, and I never drop a drink normally. So I said,
"That's why they thought you were screaming."
No. They were pretty sure I did scream. I mean, everybody said I screamed, and they said that I was at least as loud as the tugboat whistle. So I said, "Don't do anything rash." And as I left Deacus and went back to my office, I called up a friend of mine in the Alpha hardware space. His name was Jim Jackson. And I picked up the phone and said, Jim, you don't know who this guy is, and you don't know what he did, and I don't have time to explain it to you, but I have to get an Alpha system to Helsinki, Finland right away. What can you do for me? Now, back in those days, there weren't that many Alphas to go around. There were a lot of engineers at Digital who had to share Alpha systems to do their work or use one out in the noisy laboratory. There was a lot of salespeople who wanted to have seed units to give to customers. And the Alpha systems at that time were probably selling in the neighborhood of $30,000. And again, that was, you know, 10 years ago or so. So more than that, 15 years ago. So it was, you know, a lot of money. And Jim says, well, Mad Dog, you're in luck. Now you see, a lot of people think that when you're in a large company and you want to have float an idea or get something done, you write a proposal, You give it to your management. It goes through. So people consider it. They look at it. You know, they study it. They balance it. They have, you know, cost flows and stuff. That's, you can get work done that way very slowly.
Now I understand what I've been doing wrong.
But the real work, the real way you get things done is you pull in favors. Yeah. Okay. You've done favors over the years for various people and they owe you favors. Okay. And I've done a lot of favors for people at Digital and I started to pull them in. And Jim was one of the people I'd done favors for. And Jim. So he says, well, Mad Dog, I just happened to have gotten back an Alpha system. It's underneath my desk. And it has a 10 gigabyte disk drive in it. Now, remember, this is 1994.
Yeah.
Yeah. It had, I think it had a half a gigabyte of main memory. It had a 21-inch monitor, a QVision graphics card. Oh, I remember
this
that.
Is a sweet system.
It had, oh, yeah. You know, of course, it had the Alpha processor, and that one had an ESA bus on it, so that a lot of things, if old cards fit into it and stuff. And he's telling me all this stuff, right, that it's got on there, and a CD-ROM. I think it was a 2X or 4X CD-ROM. And I said, well, Jim, if you throw in an 8mm tape drive or 4mm tape drive to do a backup one, you got a deal. And he's laughing because this system is probably retailing for about $30,000. And I'm asking for a $6,000 tape drive to go with it. And he goes, well, what are you going to give? I says, I'll pay the freight.
Generous.
Right. So the next week, this system starts to go off to Helsinki, Finland. But you have to understand that we did not have any loan of products on this from this person who was supposed to receive it. The loan of products form that said that they someday would return this system. And I said, well, I'll get that signed, okay, but you send it to the Helsinki office, and then they will hold it until the paperwork is done. So it just so happened that Linus came back over to Boston for another conference, and I think it was a Usenix conference, and I met with him, and I got him to sign the loan of products form while I was eating a hot dog there. I remember that. And with the hot dog half in his mouth, he says, am I ever going to have to return this unit? I said, Linus, in the 16 years I've been with Digital, I've never seen a loan of products system come back. So probably not. And he never did return it. It was, but then again, it paid for itself many times over.
Well, he made Linux work on it. And,
right.
And what? And how long did the PowerPC port take after that? Probably never got around to that one.
Well, I think he. Well, I don't really want to talk about that because, I'll let Linus tell that story about how long it took him before he turned the PowerPC on. It arrived, by the way, about 2 weeks after the Alpha did.
Oh.
And but at that time it was too late. Linus had already made his path. Right.
How long did it take him to do the port?
Well, we got in the system in June, but then he wanted to finish up, I think it was version 1.2 of the kernel to make it stable. It was either 1.1 or 1.2. Version 1.0 had come out about the time of Deicas, and he wanted to fix a lot of the bugs and stabilize it. So he was working on that, but at the same time, I gave him a lot of Alpha documentation over the internet, so he was in the background planning what the source code tree was going to look like, how he was going to do the port. He was learning the architecture, and he did some pretty, what I thought were pretty remarkable things in the way he did the memory management of the Alpha by basically using much the same memory management as he had for the Intel, but just adding another layer of tables and stuff. I mean, he did a lot of very smart things, but there had to be a certain restructuring of the source code tree to separate out the device dependent parts from the device independent parts of the kernel. And so he's planning all of that while he was finishing up the 1.2 tree. And he actually started the project in force in January of 1995. And at the same time, I was sending out notes to the engineers at Digital in the Unix group and stuff like that. And come to find out, they had been using Linux in the engineering group for about 6 months before I really met Linus. In fact, one of them said to me, "Where in the heck have you been? We've been using it for 6 months here." Because Linux, of course, could run on a notebook, and people could do their, you know, their work on their notebooks and then bring the code in and recompile it on top of Digital Unix, and for the most part, it would work.
So did they just see it as a inexpensive Unix?
At that point, yes. Yes. And you know, it wasn't just inexpensive. It was the fact that it ran on this PC. And all of them could have PCs, but not all of them could have Alphas.
Yeah, the hardware was cheap, really.
But it wasn't the cost.
Relative, yeah.
You couldn't get them.
Right.
You couldn't get an Alpha. And they wanted to be able to do their work at home or, you know, at the weekend, and they could get the PC. And in fact, there was a guy who took the Digital Lock Manager, which was the core of VMS, and he did a lot of the porting of the code, the initial porting of the code from VMS to Unix on top of Linux, running on his notebook where he would use it out in his yard in his favorite coding place, and then he would bring it into work and put it on Digital Unix and get it to, you know, to, if there were any minor differences in the compilers, he would iron it out there and then get it to link up with the libraries.
Yeah, people don't realize just how incredibly common that was, where people would be like, "Oh, well, I've got this, quote, real Unix machine over at work or whatever. Well, let me work on it on Linux at home so I can get it done, and it's faster and snappier." And then they bring it in and run on this, you know, other thing, you know?
Right. And, you know, and they were using it for that. And again, the Alpha systems were so incredibly expensive at the time compared to some Intel machines that we actually had people in manufacturing using Linux to do work that Digital would otherwise say, well, you should be using, you know, quote, a supported operating system, you know, Digital Unix or something like that, or VMS. But we had this one guy in manufacturing who was blowing images onto the disk. He said, "Hey, the only operating system that supports all of the different file systems that I need is Linux." Right, so he was using it, and you know, for that, and it was quite interesting. But all of this was happening a little bit later on. So I started to get these messages from the different engineers inside of Digital Unix who said, "Oh, you should be talking to the Alpha Technology Group down in Hudson, where a guy by the name of Andy Reeves had a little group doing some work down there, and a guy named Jim Paradise and Jay Esterbrook were some of the core people, and later on they were joined by David Rustling, who did the Milo loader and stuff. And they had a project started up completely separate from what I had done to port Linux onto the Alpha. But they wanted to create a 32-bit kernel because they felt that there were so many more applications that were 32-bit clean, that wouldn't need any type of work to go over. And they were betting on simply the Alpha speed to be the reason why it would sell. And I convinced them. I said, "This is not a good thing." I said, "What you should do is be looking at a 64-bit port, because a lot of the information has already been ported. A lot of the programs have already been ported to 64-bit, so already 64-bit clean because of things like Digital Unix and a whole bunch of other stuff." And so they tried it. They tried a few of the utilities from the Free Software Foundation and ported it to these platforms and found out that what I said was true. And can we hold on for a second? Let me get this.
Oh, yeah, sure. We'll just edit this.
Hold on.
No problem.
John Hall.
Hey, John. Jody.
I'm on another call.
Have you heard from Bob here?
No, I haven't. I'm on another call. Okay. I'll see you later. Bye. Oh, boy. Sorry.
No, at all. It's easy to edit.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And he had known. Okay, it was. So in any case, they I talked to them and they said, "Hey, we'll go into doing this 64-bit thing. We'll join with Linus in doing this and put all of our efforts behind a 64-bit port." And again, I convinced them because I said, "Look, guys, the speed of the Alpha is wonderful, but the real advantage is a 64-bit address space and being able to go out there and access data which is you know beyond the scope of a 32-bit machine." And that's what we really should be pushing. And so they went in with that. And 9 months later, or maybe 11 months later, November of 1995, Red Hat released a distribution of Alpha Linux, which was incredibly fast to go for a port in that period of time. We look at ports these days as something that's relatively easy to do because the source code tree has already been divided up. People already understand how to do it. You know, basically it's get the compiler to work and then do a little few things down inside the base of the kernel to be able to make it fit the hardware, compile all the code. You know. But to start off from where we were and to do that port in 9 months with a volunteer community, I think was astonishing. And there were a lot of people, as you well know, who kept saying, "Oh, can't possibly be done by volunteers, but over can't, you know, impossible, can't be done, can't have a quality operation."
People still say that.
Yeah, there are some people who still say that the Earth is flat. Okay, and you know,
but so if that may be the most common thing I hear about open source software is, well, how could you expect programs written by volunteers in their spare time to be anywhere near as good as programs written by professionals who are getting paid for it?
Don't get me started on that. That would be another whole show about the discussion of professionalism. No, don't get me going down that path, okay?
We'll take it as written.
Okay, you can put that as notes for the next for some future show, okay? But we started a project going and we finished it up. And then I went to Red Hat and I says, "Oh, this is great. You know, what I'd like to do is buy about 2,000 of those Alpha CDs and give them out to people and stuff." And Red Hat says, "Well, you know, if you do that, nobody's going to buy our package. And then we won't get the money back for the work we did in putting together the distribution." And I said, "Well, okay, well, what happens if I pay for 2,000 Intel versions of that release and go around spraying those things out and saying, gee, try this out on your PC, and if you like this, you know, you'll love the Alpha because it'll be faster and have a bigger address space." And Red Hat thought about that for about 10 microseconds and said, "Gee, that's a great idea." So I bought 2,000 copies of it. And we had the digital logo on it and the Red Hat Running Man logo. Remember him?
Sure, yeah.
And I started taking those out, and I felt like Johnny Appleseed handing these things out to people. "Here, you know, put this on your computer. Try it out," right? And I think the best time I had doing that was going down to Australia on a trip and attending one of the early Linux Australia conferences, handing that out. On the way back, I stopped off on the island of Fiji, a little layover, and I stopped at this place called the Hideaway Resort for a little vacation. And unfortunately for me, the digital salesman on the island of Fiji found me and asked that I come to the capital and talk with the university there about Linux. And so I went to the university and was talking to them, and I found out that they had heard about Linux, but it was difficult for them to get a copy because at that time the entire island of Fiji was linked to the internet by something like 1,200 bit per second modem. And so by the time they tried to FTP a copy of the kernel down, they get halfway through it, and some storm in the South Pacific would hit and drop the line. So I took my last CD I had with me, and I gave it to them, and I said, here's the entire operating system and all the source code for it, for all the things you need to teach your classes. And as I handed out that CD to them, I felt a little bit like the painting in the Sistine Chapel, you know, of Adam and God. And God is giving the touch of intelligence to Adam, right? I felt a little bit like that.
So cool.
And then I began to realize the real value that I would be handing over to these people who desperately needed it, the equivalent of billions of dollars of intellectual property and work that had been contributed by people all over the world simply because they wanted a better operating system and they wanted better compilers and they wanted it to be at a price that anybody could afford and anybody could contribute. And that's when I really began to understand the whole thing. And, you know, maybe people like Richard Stallman understood that aspect of it, or, you know, maybe earlier than I did. And maybe what all I understood was free software I could use. But to see those people look at it and say, oh my goodness, you know, all this stuff. There's a little, I left the island right after that, went home, but there's another story to that. I went back 2 years later to Australia, stopped off at Fiji, went to the same resort, same guy found me. And I asked him, I said, are the people at the university still using Linux? And he goes, oh, none of them are using Linux. Mm. I says, really? None of them are using Linux? He said, no. He says, I'm their salesman. You know, they haven't said anything to me about it the entire 2 years, and I would know if they were using it. And I says, well, can we go there anyway? And he says, I'd like to talk with them. And he says, oh, yeah, sure. So he takes me to the university and then takes me into the department head, right? And I say, hi, I'm John Hall. We met 2 years ago. Oh, yeah. We'd like to talk with you, you know? And he's called all the professors together. Now, this is the University of the Pacific, right? And the professors, it's very casual down there. A lot of professors dress in sarongs and stuff like that. And they come in, and they all line up, and I say, how many of you are using Linux on your desktop or notebooks or service systems? And they all raise their hand, and my salesman kind of like falls off of his chair onto the floor out of surprise. And afterwards, when we got outside, he says, I don't understand it. They didn't say a single word to me in 2 years, not a single word. I said, it's because they didn't have to. I said, they had everything they needed. They don't need you anymore. I says, they're not going to be forced to come to you for everything they need. You're going to be forced to go to them, and you're going to be forced to say, how can I help you? How can I make your life better? You're going to have to work. That's right, Chris. You're going to have to work. And his face, I just ruined his whole day, probably his whole week. So it was a good time. And they were using Linux all over the place down there. It was a good time.
Wow. You were Johnny Appleseed.
It was great. I mean, just hanging out those CDs, and it continued to go on. You know, at CeBIT, the world's largest computer show, we had, the first time I went there, we had this little booth that Linux International had rented, and we had a couple of our customers there, a couple of our member companies. Red Hat was there. Bob Young from Red Hat was there. And somebody from SUSE, I think it was maybe Ransom Love. No, it wasn't from SUSE.
It was Caldera at the time.
But Ransom was there. It was from Caldera. And there was somebody there from SUSE. And we would take turns staffing the booth. I was there most of the time, and we'd typically have one or two of the other people there. And we'd be handing out the CDs. Well, everybody, of course, wanted to make sure their CD got into the hands of each customer. So each customer typically walked away with three CDs at a time, one for each operating system. And as soon as people found out that we were handing these things out, there was this big crowd that would come in. They would like push us to the back of the booth. And we're just handing these CDs out as fast as we can. And all of a sudden, I look around, and Bob Young wasn't anywhere to be seen. I said, you know, where's Bob? Where's Bob? And about that time, I'd open up the door in the back to get more CDs, and there was Bob in the back making a telephone call. But it was, you know, it was a time where there was real cooperation between these different companies, because the main thrust was to get people using Linux, and then later on to carve up the pie, you know, grow the pie, and then worry about carving it up. But if you don't make the pie any bigger, you're only going to end up with a small piece of pie. And that was what the Unix community, not the community, but the Unix vendors never understood. They never promoted Unix as an entire product. They were only worried about promoting their own products.
You know, as I would love to go on for another 4 hours, but but I think we should wrap this one up. And I just, what I'm thinking, Mad Dog, is we'd like to make you a part of Floss Weekly and join us whenever you can, bring in your guests and so forth, because Chris has a new baby, so.
Yeah, I've been pretty busy, so it's been like Floss Monthly, and so we've been thinking about other hosts we can bring in.
So would you be willing to do that, Mad Dog?
Sure, and you know, I like both you guys, and I think it'll be fun, and I can try and go out and find some other people, which I think would be equally interesting. I mean, have you ever had Mark Spencer on the air?
We have not had Mark Spencer.
Love to.
Mark Spencer, the architect of Asterisk, really nice guy, and you know, he'd be good.
We went to breakfast with him in Toronto a couple of years ago at Linux World, and it was great, or Asterisk World, and it was really fun, really interesting guy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks to Mad Dog.
And you know, there's also, you know, yeah, I know some people, and again, I travel quite a bit, and if I go someplace like Brazil or something like that, I could get some people from down there.
That would be fun.
That'd be
Skype,
great.
Skype allows us to do this anywhere you are, so
that's true.
That would be really fun.
Well, although I will admit that some places the echo quality becomes, yeah, and the delay, you can hear the delay quality as because the codec is compressing and decompressing.
Right.
But,
well, you know, the other side of this is you can just do the interview yourself, you know, and then, you know, Leo can sort of bumper it. And
that's
done,
true, too. I, you know, Chris bought we reimbursed him a portable recorder and a microphone, and I'd be glad to get the same for you. And we can just put them together when you get back.
Okay. Well, I also have very nice iRiver.
Oh, perfect.
Portable recorder I could use.
Yeah, those
so
are great.
I'll just hold off and do that for right now, good, and then I can, you know, and later on, if for some reason we feel that that's not good, we can do something else.
Well, in many cases, Skype works surprisingly well, and now in these countries that have good upstream bandwidth, I've been getting great results, even around the world, you know. Much better than the phone system, ironically. These guys are good. They know what they're doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, they do.
Well,
and there's a lot of people that don't like Skype for, you know, some reason, because they say it's commercial and stuff like that. But I'm really kind of a pragmatic open source guy. You know, I don't tell people to sit there and throw out something that's working perfectly fine, that they're perfectly happy with. You know, on the other hand, since that's relatively few, like, there's lots of people that should be going to open source.
That's a good point. That's a good point. I wish they would open Skype, but I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. Fortunately, they do give it away, and it really is an amazing program. It just works great.
Works under Linux, too.
Yep. They had the good sense to do that anyway. Mad Dog, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us. You know, you wind Mad Dog up, and you will hear story after story. He has done so much, and he's been around, and he's such a great guy. I just adore him. And it's very sincere, his desire to connect people and turn them on to Linux.
Yeah, I mean, and he loves it. You know, he's been doing this forever. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've had beer with this guy. Locally, there's a place called the Tide House, and they have these numbered mugs, and he is number zero.
Wow.
You know, because he used to often, that, and when they started this thing up, and they already gotten like 13 or 14 into it, he's like, can I have number zero?
Mug zero.
They're like, sure. So in a lot of ways, John is sort of mug zero for Linux.
Perfect. We'll put that on his tombstone, which won't be for a long, long time. And as we mentioned, John's going to be a regular on this show and is going to start doing some episodes. That'll take some of the burden off you, Chris, because I know you're very busy and you've got your...
Yeah, well, and also, you know, people like the show. They should be able to get more of it, you know?
Gosh knows, there's plenty of open source to talk about. And
yeah, exactly.
So we don't know what's next week. We haven't scheduled it yet, but I'm sure we'll have one. And between you and Mad Dog, I think we're going to have lots of exciting Floss Weeklies to come. Chris, all the best to you. Get to work on that master plan, will you?
Will do.
See you later. See you next week.
Bye.
On Floss Weekly.